Remember Megyn Kelly? She was a great guest on The Dirt Show. She was also a guest the other night on The Bill Maher Show, and she said she was taking her kids out of an elite school in New York City because of the way they were making parents and students feel guilty about being white and how they were teaching issues of racism. We'll discuss that and the general issue of how you teach about and discuss race. We'll discuss all of those issues on today's Dirt Show. Megyn Kelly's recent appearance on the Bill Maher Show once again raised the issue of how schools, kindergartens through universities, should be teaching students about race, about racial issues, about racial discrimination. If you watch the Bill Maher interview, it was quite dramatic. Megyn Kelly, who describes herself as a centrist, kind of leaning right, leaning Republican. She said many of her family are Democrats, but she's certainly not an extremist by any means. She's not any longer associated with Fox. She has her own podcast. She was a guest on this show, on this podcast. She dramatically described how she had to take her children out of an Upper East Side or Upper West Side, New York, very fancy school, elementary school and high school, because of the way they were talking to students and parents about race. According to Megyn Kelly, were making white kids seem guilty about white privilege and about white claims of white superiority or things of that kind. In other words, she felt that instead of having dialogue with students about race and instead of simply alerting them to the problems we have in this country, we have serious problems about race, they were propagandizing students and making them feel terrible and separating them on racial grounds. They were essentially basing their education on identity politics, on what your ethnicity or race is more important than the quality of your character, a direct rejection of Martin Luther King's dream that someday we will live in a society where his children will be judged based on the quality of their character rather than the color of their skin. Obviously, the country is immersed in a great debate about that issue. Is the best way to confront our racial problems to keep people separate and to emphasize racial differences, or is it to try to reduce racial differences and treat everybody as common human beings with common aspirations? It's worth debating. It's worth discussing. It's certainly worth discussing on The Dirt Show, and we will continue to discuss what the right approach is. As I've said before, talking about race is very difficult. Talking about religion is very difficult. In fact, I think there are some comparisons that can be made. It's so interesting that people on the left today say it's perfectly okay to attack Zionism, to attack Israel. That's not attacking Jews. That's just attacking a country, Israel. Yeah, it's the nation state of the Jewish people and all that. But, you know, you can be an anti-Zionist without being an anti-Semite. You can be singling out Israel for unique condemnation and criticism the way the UN does without being deemed bigoted or anti-Semitic. Okay, that's a point of view. But the same, many of the same people who say that say, but you can't attack Black Lives Matter. No, that's bigotry. That's racism. Well, what's the difference? Black Lives Matter is not all black people. Black Lives Matter is a political organization that has a program, that has an agenda, that has a platform. The platform includes many terrible, terrible things in it, including accusing Israel of being a genocidal apartheid country. So why can't I criticize Black Lives Matter if you can criticize Zionism, the national liberation movement of the Jewish people? Why is it fair to criticize the national liberation movement of the Jewish people and not fair to accuse movements of African American people? Obviously, I think we all think it would be wrong to say blacks are and then fill in the blank with stereotypes, or Jews are, or Muslims are. It's perfectly fair to say that there are people within Islam who preach hatred of America and preach hatred of Jews and preach hatred of non-Muslims. There are people within Islam, imams, who preach violence. That's perfectly okay to say, and I think it's fair to say that there are people within the Black Lives Movement who advocate violence. As I talked on a previous show, Fred Hampton is being glorified in a great movie. I really enjoyed the movie. I thought it was really excellent. But he's being somewhat glorified. I know the Fred Hampton case very well. I was an active lawyer in the civil rights movement when he was killed, and I mourned his death. But he was a man who advocated killing police officers. That was part of the Black Panther program, along with many good things in the Black Panther program. But it wasn't all good. It advocated violence. And today, there are those within the Black Lives Matter movement who advocate defunding the police. That's a terrible, terrible idea. Defunding the police reduces the protection that many vulnerable African-Americans and others have and who need police protection. We ought to be increasing the funding of police. We ought to be raising their salaries. We ought to be increasing educational programs for the police. We ought to be developing more non-lethal weapons for the police. We have to increase funding for the police. And if anybody tells me we have to defund the police, whether it's AOC or anyone else, I'm going to fight against them. I'm not going to fight in the sense that people can be accused of engaging in violence. I'm going to argue against them in the marketplace of ideas, which brings us back to how do you teach about race and ethnicity and bigotry and discrimination and our terrible, terrible history of slavery in kindergartens, in elementary schools, in high schools, and in colleges. It's not only race. How do you teach about gender? How do you teach about transgender? One of the complaints that is going around is that kids in the lowest grades in elementary school, 7 and 8 year olds, are being taught about transgender issues before they're really ready to think hard about these issues. Kids that age don't really understand sex, gender issues of that kind. But if you're a propagandist, it's never too early. It was Karl Marx who said, give me a child at the age of 7 or 8, and I won't worry about how the rest of his education operates. So, you know, it's important to distinguish between propagandizing students about one view of race or gender and educating them and teaching them how to ask questions. I go back to being very proud of the fact that in 50 years of teaching and 10,000 students at Harvard, I never expressed my personal views in the classroom. My job was not to teach the students what to think about capital punishment. I'm a strong opponent of capital punishment, but you wouldn't know that from attending my class. My job was not to propagandize students against the death penalty. My job was to teach students how to think about the death penalty, what the arguments are on all sides, what the arguments are on all sides of racial issues. When I taught a course on where does your morality come from, I'm not sure I could do this today. I assigned my students. These were 15 students from elite high schools, first year at Harvard College. It was a great class. I really enjoyed teaching it. I had 500 applicants for 15 places. People would clamor to get into the class because I was questioning them about the sources of their morality. And of course, everybody in the class, of course, was against slavery and against racial discrimination. But I assigned them to read the writings of Calhoun and others justified slavery. That talked about how slavery was a better way of treating working people than the way we treated day workers in New York who came right off the boat from places like Ireland and were treated horribly because they weren't property, they weren't worth anything. So the employer didn't care if they died 2 days, they could just simply be replaced. Whereas the slave owner, according to these writings, cared about their property, wanted to preserve their property. Was it nonsense? Of course. It was a justification of a horrible, horrible institution. But I wanted the students to read it. I wanted the students to read Dostoevsky's Attack on Jews. I wanted the students to read what people were reading in Germany in the 1930s or 1940s that turned them into the monsters they became at places like Auschwitz. I wanted the students to be exposed to every possible point of view. so that they can decide for themselves. Is that happening today in ethnic studies programs that are becoming mandatory in more parts of the country? Are the students hearing all sides of issues regarding race and gender and politics? Or are they simply being propagandized to one particular view? We now have these programs where teachers and parents and sometimes students are required to attend seminars where they're preached morality and told that they're all racists and told that they all take advantage of their white privilege. I remember even when I was teaching at Harvard Law School, we had a session, I think it was a mandatory session, we all had to go, in which a very brilliant psychologist told us all that we were unconscious racists and showed us pictures on the board and made us answer questions that surfaced our hidden racism. Is that an interesting experiment? Perhaps. As long as it's done with an open mind, as long as it's done allowing students to come to their own views. You know, when I've had cases, jury trials or judge cases, I never tell the jury, I never tell the judge what to conclude. I find that it's much more effective advocacy to lead the fact finder, the judge, the jury, up to the point where they then have the aha moment. They say, aha, oh yeah, it follows from that. Let it be their conclusion, not have the conclusion forced on people and imposed on them. That's not what education is about. So I'm concerned about what's going on in California and other parts of the country which have ethnic studies programs that aren't really programs that invite students to think about ethnicity, to consider all sides of every issue, no matter how one-sided the issue seems to be. Let them come to their own conclusions. Let them not be told there's necessarily right or wrong ways of approaching issues of racism. And this is particularly the case with the issue of race, with the issue of whether it's better to emphasize racial differences and to do identity politics and to separate students based on racial identity, or is it better to try to have students focus on what unites them, what brings them together, the contingency of race rather than the absoluteness of race as a forever dividing point? Those are debatable issues, and I suspect that Americans are as divided about that issue as they are about so many issues. And there is no right or wrong. You can't say that Martin Luther King was wrong and that Malcolm X was right. They had different positions on that, the way Jews, right from the beginning of Zionism, have had different positions on Zionism. There were assimilationist Jews who said, let's just become like everybody else. Let's avoid identity politics. There were Jews who said, no, let's have a nation state for the Jewish people in which we can live independently and have our own literature, our own music, our own army. Reasonable people could disagree about those issues. I think the same thing is true about gender. There are those who say that men and women should find common ground, and others would say, no, there's something unique and special about gender, particularly about being a woman, and that should be emphasized in academic work and other work. And I praise that. I praise that approach as long as there's an alternative to it, as long as students can say no. We prefer to look at issues not through the lens of race and gender and ethnicity and religion, but through the lens of economics. There's a black professor who has gotten into a lot of trouble because he says there's been too much emphasis on race and not enough emphasis on class. The Smith College issue that we talked about on the show a few days ago raises the conflict between class and race. Here you have a privileged black student attacking unprivileged white janitors and security officials at an elite university that costs $75,000 to attend and where the janitors make a fraction of that as salary, and where the emphasis seems to be on preferring racial divisions over class divisions. These are issues that should be discussed. The problem in America is we don't discuss. We just berate. We just propagandize. We just pick sides. We pick racial sides. We pick gender sides. We pick religious sides. We pick ethnic sides. We pick political sides. We pick ideological sides. Once you've picked a side, there's no use discussing. Your side has the truth with a capital T truth. And if your side has the truth, why do you need to present another side? Why do you need to read the literature that justifies slavery or anti-Semitism or anti-Catholicism or anything else? Should you be reading Thomas Jefferson and John Adams railing against Jesuits back in the founding time of our country? Yes, it's part of our education. We've had a terrible history of anti-Catholicism in this country going back to its very founding. There are laws on the statute books of Massachusetts. I used to read them to the students. They were shocked. That made it a crime to house a Jesuit in Massachusetts, because if Jesuits ever come to Massachusetts, they will destroy all America. That kind of anti-Catholic bigotry was rampant in the United States. Jefferson and Adams thought that we were a Protestant country. George Washington said, no, we allow everybody to sit under their fig tree, and as long as they're good Americans of toleration, we will no longer speak, as if by the one group's permission, another group survives. No, we're a country of immigrants. We're a country of diversity. But diversity has to extend beyond identity politics. Diversity has to extend to ideological diversity, political diversity, all kinds of diversity, economic diversity, and education has to again be for purposes of teaching students how to think about complex issues. Now, there may be a difference between teaching science and teaching about a race. In science, at least for the moment, there are right answers. Everybody thought Newton had all the right answers until Einstein came along, and everybody thought Einstein had the right answers until some of the more recent string theorists came along. But science, at least, you strive for a truth in the end, a truth that may change over time. But when it comes to issues of race, when it comes to issues of religion, ethnicity, politics, there is no absolute right or wrong answer. There is a process of considering and deciding these issues in a rational way. Today, it's become a sin to accept Martin Luther King's approach to race. It's a sin to say that the situation regarding race has improved dramatically in this country over the last 50 or 60 years, even though the reality is that there has been major improvement, not enough. We have a long, long, long way to go when it comes to equality, racial equality, gender equality, religious equality. We still have too much bigotry in this country. But the goal of education is not to be on the forefront of solving social justice problems in America. That's the role of advocates. The role of education is to prepare students to live in a thinking world, to make up their own minds, to come to their own conclusions, to become thinking people in a democracy, able to express their own views, their own religious views, their own views regarding race. And so, yeah, I think we have to have a skeptical view toward propaganda. And we have to worry about what's going on in some schools today. Was Megyn Kelly right or wrong? I leave that to you. She's always invited back to the Dirr Show to discuss her views. So would you take your children out of a school that propagandized them and made them feel guilty about slavery, made them feel guilty about the way our ancestors or our predecessors treated Native Americans? Or would you prefer them to go to a school in which all kinds of questions were raised and students were permitted to come to their own conclusions? Well, one thing is for sure. On the Dirr Show, you're always going to hear all sides of every issue. I'm not afraid to buck the norms of political correctness. I will deal with issues of race and gender sensitively, and but without fear of being accused of being too provocative. So if you want to engage in conversations about subjects that are difficult to talk about, join the Dirt Show, subscribe to the Dirt Show, listen to the Dirt Show. In my last couple of years of teaching at Harvard, I taught a very provocative and interesting course class with a colleague of mine, and the name of the class was Taboo. And the content was, in this class, we will have 15 sessions. It was a university-wide class. I taught it with Steven Pinker, who's a brilliant, brilliant linguist, psychologist, all-around intellectual. And the subject matter in the 15 weeks was 15 issues that were taboo to talk about at Harvard and other universities. And students clamored for it. They wanted to have an opportunity to talk about taboo subjects. And we did. And there was no propagandizing. Students from every point of view were given an opportunity to hear their views and so and to express their views. And so taboo, the teaching of taboo, is a model for how I'm going to conduct the Dirt Show. So there's no such thing as a taboo issue on the Dirt Show. And please, ask me taboo questions. And don't worry. Do it politely. Do it sensitively. We don't want to encourage any kind of racism, sexism, bigotry, homophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Catholicism, anti-Islam. We don't want to encourage any of that on this show. But ask me any question. Make any comment that raises concerns, legitimate concerns, about these divisive issues in our deeply, deeply divided country. So the Dirt Show is where you can have that discussion. Let's now turn to our questions and comments, the wits that completes the Dirt Show wits. So here's our first call, first comment on today's Dirt Show.
Alan, I'm a student at Claremont McKenna College in Claremont, California, and a victim of cancel culture. For the past year and 4 months, my school has been trying to effectively expel me for speech that other students deemed was offensive. As the managing editor of the right-wing paper and a board member of religious groups such as Chabad on campus. Despite FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, reaching out on my behalf and demanding the school cease their investigations, they have not done anything. And I'm reaching out to you right now, as you mentioned in the previous episode about cancel culture.
Well, thanks for your call. I need to know a lot more specifics about your matter. If you could write me or email me or leave a more detailed message with a phone number, I'd be happy to call you back. You also have to tell me whether or not the college you attend is a public or private university, and I'm happy to either try to assist you. I don't believe in cancellation, but I have to know the facts. So thanks for your call, and give me more information and perhaps call back if you want to with more information, and we can discuss your case if you'd like to on the Dirt Show.
Hi, Attorney Dershowitz. I just found out that the Biden administration wants to charge reporters $170 every time they go to a briefing. Are they able to do that? Aren't they violating the First Constitutional Amendment of freedom of the press? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe on the show you could comment on that. I'm curious. I believe they're violating the First Amendment Constitution, First Constitution Amendment. Thank you. Bye.
Good question. I think it would depend on what happened if you had a small newspaper, an independent journalist who couldn't afford the hundred and whatever dollars to come to the press briefing. That might raise First Amendment questions. But to charge everybody a standard fee to attend the press conference doesn't sound very smart to me. But I don't see the constitutional violation if it's done across the board.
Hi, this is Mark White from Hawaii. And my question is regarding the cancellation of the Clarence Thomas documentary from Amazon's streaming service? And also, what was your take on the confirming of Clarence Thomas to Supreme Court Justice? What was your take on the effect that Anita Hill had on the Me Too movement?
It's a great question. Anita Hill may have been a predecessor to the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement really started with the allegations regarding Harvey Weinstein. I've consulted with his lawyers on his case, so I'm not unbiased on the legal issues growing out of the Harvey Weinstein case. Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings were not well done, not well conducted. She wasn't given as full an opportunity to present her arguments as she should have been. For me, the Clarence Thomas hearing should have been more about what President Bush said when he nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, saying he was the most qualified individual in the United States to serve on the high court. You could not say that with a straight face. He has proved to be a divisive justice. For years, he didn't ask any questions. I don't think he has been the greatest nominee to the Supreme Court, but it was the beginning of using confirmation hearings as a way of airing sexual issues. It came to a low point in the Kavanaugh hearings where people were making wild accusations and others were making what seemed like perhaps accusations that they believed to be true, but they went back to time when the nominee was a high school student. It was not the finest moment in confirmation. I wrote about that extensively. I wrote a book called Confirming Justice, and it goes into the whole process of how we confirm our justices. Not a particularly elevated process today. It probably goes back, started more with the Bork confirmation than any other single event in our history, and I'm looking forward to seeing what happens when there are vacancies now under President Biden, how the Democrat-controlled Senate, with a equally divided number, 50-50, the tie being broken by the Democrat vice president, will handle these confirmations. I know that President Biden is thinking about appointing a commission to look into the future of the Supreme Court. We'll wait and see who he appoints, who's on that commission, and whether they consider court packing, which I think would be a disaster. What I do think makes sense are term limits for justices of the Supreme Court, 18 years, 15 years, 20 years. But I don't believe that the mandatory retirement age makes any sense, because that would just encourage presidents to appoint younger and younger and younger justices. So these are complicated issues, and Clarence Thomas case certainly was the beginning of a trend in the wrong direction.
Hello, this is Dr. Romano. In your explanation of defending the terrorists to come into the country to give a lecture, don't we as citizens also have a right to be safe from someone that's potentially dangerous? Mm-hmm. I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
You make my point exactly. The hypothetical I gave was a terrorist who was not allowed to come into the United States because of safety concern. Yes, we are entitled to keep terrorists out of this country. We're entitled to keep people out of this country who advocate terrorism. We have very, very broad powers to keep people out of the country. My point was, do we have powers to keep people from speaking by Zoom from a foreign country to an audience in this country? Take that recent case of, I think her name is Leila Khalad, who had hijacked the El Al plane and another plane in England. And she is not only a terrorist, but somebody who advocates terrorism. She was invited to speak to students at, I think, the University of San Francisco. She wasn't trying to come into the country. She'd be arrested if she came into the country. She is a terrorist, an attempted murderer. But she wanted to make a speech from wherever she lives, in Lebanon or somewhere else, to students in the United States. And I use that as a really good hypothetical as to who has the right. She has no rights in America. She has no right to speak. She's not a citizen. She's a wanted terrorist. She has no rights at all. but do the students who are American citizens, law-abiding, have the right to hear her and listen to her point of view? And I think the answer to that question is yes. So I was using that hypothetical to break down the issue as to between the right to speak on the one hand and the right to listen on the other hand. So I wasn't arguing that she should be allowed into the country to endanger our lives as a wanted terrorist, only that audience members who wanted to listen to her have an independent right, independent from her right to be in the country or to speak. I'd be interested in what you think about that.
Hello, Professor, and thank you for the wonderful show. My name is Rick, and I'm from Philadelphia. My question is, during the impeachment hearings, we kept hearing that Trump was guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. In the normal law world, felonies are reduced to misdemeanors. What is a presidential misdemeanor? I don't understand it. Can you enlighten us? Thank you.
You're not alone in not understanding the term high misdemeanor. I think everybody agrees that the terms high crimes and misdemeanors mean high crimes, and the word high also modifies misdemeanors. You can't be impeached for, getting a traffic ticket or another mild misdemeanor. At common law, at the time that those words were put into our Constitution, misdemeanor had a somewhat different meaning. It could be a quite serious crime, but it didn't carry with it the attainting of blood and the forfeiture of property and all of that. Indeed, Blackstone, who was the great writer on the common law, talked about misdemeanor as being a species of crime, and you could even have a capital misdemeanor. My recollection is that if you shot and killed the king's deer or the king's animals, that was a capital misdemeanor. You could be literally hanged for doing it, even though it was not a felony. A felony carried with it other consequences for your family and for your heritage. A misdemeanor didn't carry those, but it could be quite serious. So the way I understand high crimes and misdemeanors in the Constitution is it has to be a pretty serious criminal-type behavior, but the word high relates to it has to be part of your governance. So I think that what Bill Clinton was accused of committing was a crime and misdemeanor, but it was a low crime, not a high crime. It was basically lying about sex in the Oval Office, much like Hamilton's crimes. Hamilton committed adultery when he was the Secretary of Treasury, and then he paid extortion money, blackmail money, to the husband of the person with whom he had committed adultery. But nobody would suggest that that was a high crime. It was a low crime. But it was a crime. It may have been a misdemeanor, but it would satisfy the constitutional criteria for misdemeanor, but not the constitutional criteria for high. So it's complicated. The framers could have picked better words, but one thing is clear. They didn't intend to include abuse of power, maladministration, obstruction of Congress. None of those were meant to be included within the very daunting criteria of high crimes and misdemeanors. I made that point on the floor of the Senate last January, and I stand by that point today.
Hi, this is Itzik Bassman from Toronto, Canada. Short, simple question, maybe not so simple, is whether you could just explain in a few minutes the idea of substantive due process and give an example of it and maybe highlight where it would apply where other amendments in the Bill of Rights wouldn't. Thank you.
You ask a very important question. This was a debate that occurred primarily in the first half of the 20th century among American scholars and judges and justices. Everybody understands what procedural due process means. You have to have the right to respond. You have to have the right to put on evidence, the right to cross-examine witnesses. All of that are procedural due process. What is substantive due process? Substantive due process was used as a way of striking down legislation during the New Deal and other reform periods. And so many liberals came out against substantive due process because it was cutting back on liberal legislative programs. And ultimately, the Supreme Court kind of moved away from substantive due process, challenging substantive legislation, not because the procedures were wrong, but because the end result was that you were denied certain rights, the right of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, and property, however you want to phrase it. It's kind of in disrepute today, substantive due process, but there are people who are trying to bring it back. Some argued, for example, that the right of gays to marry was substantive due process. Others said, no, it was privacy and equality. So we're going to continue to have this debate about whether there's any content to substantive due process. And right now, I would say the answer to the question remains uncertain. If you're going to argue substantive due process, the burden is pretty heavily on you. And the answer is normally pretty easy for the other side. All I have to do is show some rational relation between the legislative goals and the means used. But it's a great question, and it really goes to the power of the different branches of government. It goes directly to the issues of separation of powers and checks and balances. So again, great question. You know, these questions are fantastic. They really go to the heart of our democracy, and they're the kinds of questions that I would encourage all the time from students at Harvard Law School. I wonder whether those questions are being asked today at Harvard Law School, or whether today's students are a little afraid to ask certain kinds of questions, questions that might suggest political correctness, suggestions that might get them canceled, suggestions. I'll give you an example. Again, would a student today at Harvard Law School be able to raise the question about whether President Trump's speech on January 6th was covered by the First Amendment? After all, two or three of the leading professors at Harvard said that was a frivolous question. That was bonkers. That was a question that no responsible jurist, no responsible scholar would ever ask. And if you're in Professor Tribe's class, or if you're in Professor Freed's class, and you know they've already committed on that issue, saying that's not an appropriate question to ask. It is a legally frivolous point, and it's not a question that any responsible scholar or jurist would ask. Would you feel comfortable raising that question in the classroom of Professor Tribe or Professor Freed? I don't know. I wouldn't be afraid, because I'm a gutsy guy, and I asked very hard questions when I was a student, and even harder questions when I was a professor. But if I were, you know, a 21 or 22-year-old law student trying to make my way in the world, I don't think I would raise that point in Professor Tribe's class or Professor Freed's class. I think it was a very, very serious mistake and a very serious violation of the academic freedom of students for professors to denominate those kinds of issues as beyond the pale of discussion in a classroom. So I worry about the future of legal education. I worry about the future of America in the sense of how divided we are. But on the Dirt Show, you can ask any question you want. You will never be told that your question is bonkers. You will never be told that it's not scholarly or injudicious. You'll never be told that it's frivolous. That's not for me. That may be for Tribe and Freed, but you're never going to hear that on the Dirt Show. So please tell your friends about the show. Please subscribe. And please, more questions, more comments for the Dirt Show. An important part of the Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.